It's a real pleasure to introduce Harriet Roby. Right in the beginning of the retreat, I did a reading from a book that she wrote, her first book, finished after she did her first retreat at IMS at the age of 80. The title of the book, as Joseph mentioned, was There's a Dance in the Old Dame Yet. And as you can see, there's still a dance in the old dame. One of the real beauties of such a person is expressed also within the book as her reason for writing the book, one of the reasons. As she became aware of her own old age and felt a need for a resource for information as to how to relate to many of the issues of old age and losing her husband and being in this world, she realized that as she searched the literature, that all the literature about old age was written by young people. And it's really inspiring to me that someone who, for no other reason than to provide the information and to help others with this process, has decided that it is right and appropriate for communication to come from the experience and to share that. Since that first book, she wrote a second book and is now writing a third book. And it's a great pleasure to have her here today. So she will share some of this wealth of experience and knowledge with us, and then take questions and whatever.
You know, it's a damnedest feeling in this beloved place, and it is beloved because I have come away with such, this is the sixth time I've been here in 7 years, to come away with so much peace and quietude. And it is tickles my soul to be sitting up here instead of being a very humble yogi. So here I am giving words on age from the horse's mouth. I'm a fine gerontological specimen of 76. Not too long off to be 77. And I would like to speak about, in a way, what you're all here for, where you're going, and how it's going to help in old age and in dying. Because I've got dying ahead of me. Lord knows how far ahead. And I know damn well that the fact that I have learned to meditate and learned through biofeedback to handle pain, that I am not likely to be prey to the ordinary ailments of age, but that I will go on following the way which I started the first time I got here. I've always kind of searched to be myself, to know myself, as the Buddha says, know your heart and know your mind. And do not be afraid, so that You know, every time I say a year, it makes me annoyed. All the other leaders have always stopped and put their thoughts together and spoken clearly after that little silence. I should dare to be silent for a moment. So, aging, you're all here for a purpose, either out of pain, desire to learn, and the pain can be emotional or physical, or the question about your own futures and aging, or how to lead a kind and pure life with love in it. And we start aging, aware of aging, about 40. We've never noticed old people before, except as they were kindly grandparents or nuisances. And now, starting probably with eyeglasses between 40 and 50, and then a little lessening of energy and less sense of virility, I think, among some of the men. And certainly the annoyance with women of loss of their body image, their figures, their shape. It's wonderful being blind because I can't see my own wrinkles. And you go on one step after the other. We've had losses from the beginning, from the time we lost that Ouroboros, if anybody knows Jung's, I mean, that old symbol of unity before the ego developed. That to become a person and having to separate from the breast, from that nirvana or that oceanic feeling, and going into individuality and the torments of adolescence and the pain in it, and the pain of love and marriage, and yet the joys along with it. But aging is something else. It is more losses. One loss, well, there's the loss of a lover, there's a loss of a job, there are many losses, and every one, if it's seen right, is a little death. And every little death prepares us, if we do it with courage, for the final big death. We don't know that at first. But as time goes on, as I lost my eyesight because I can only see dimly, peripherally in one eye, the other eye is gone, as I lost my ability to sit upright or stand upright, as I lost leg circulation, these were due to two nasty accidents. I realized that the mind and the creativity of the mind and the clean mind was the most wonderful thing there was, never mind the body. The path is a lonely one. You shed the garments, if you've had the courage, the garments of conservatism or of your own ingraining, training as a child, and dared to become individuals following the path that something was pushing you toward. And in following that path, and it's a very lonely one, because criticism can come from right and left, but you're finding out that you can be what you were meant to be and to be true to yourself, which again is a cry of the Buddha. Older and older and more incapacitation and more adjustments and more aloneness. It's that fulfilling of the mind's curiosity. Never let the curiosity, the ingenuity, the figuring out, the wanting to know, never let it go. And of course, I'm bursting with it. I think this is why my first book was published. There was a privately published one. My family was so afraid that I would get psychological about this, because I come from a very conservative New England family that doesn't allow feelings. That was privately published. A lot of research went into it. That was published in 1980, my first writing. Oh, wonderful. The second one in 82, which Eric has spoken about. The third one in 84. There's been a somewhat of a hiatus as I have adjusted to more blindness. But heaven help me, I'm even learning to use a word processor. And the gadgets I have in terms of recording machines and machines for the blind and recordings from tape and disc and so forth, and all of them with different stops and all opening differently, and all have to be memorized. Wonderful for the mind. But the point about death coming is that with this work of never being afraid of the things you think. Sitting in meditation, anger or rage comes. What to do with it? Get back to the breathing, but recognize it. I am still aware of anger. I try and plan things out as well as I can. But if I'm betrayed in some way, it still comes the cry, don't you do that to me. Or helplessness. Because, well, I'm on familiar territory. I cook for myself and take care of myself, except for weekly cleaning, a weekly secretary. The individuality of I am alone and on my own. Incidentally, I have 28 descendants out of my husband's in my blood, and they're loving and they're caring and they come. And the mothers send their daughters to me if there are problems that they can't deal with their daughters, so they say, go talk to grandma. But it's a rich inner life, always on a search for how to handle the bursts of anger or annoyance and constant frustration with the eyes. Pouring from a half-gallon jug of vodka into a nice glass decanter. I couldn't seem to fill it. I had a funnel. Couldn't seem to fill it. Poured. Couldn't see. Well, I had long since filled it, and it was flowing over the counter and over the floor. All right. All you can do is laugh. So I'm always laughing but learning from my mistakes. The thing about anger is, and this is the great question in my mind, where the Buddha said, master your anger, is since anger comes from the limbic system, the fight flight primitive system, and can up like this at you, how can you stop it from coming? Right? You can't. All you can do is chase it down, almost like a detective story. Where did this come from, and what happened that made this burst out? Because anger, for me, puts my back in spasm. So that it's a long process of learning to chase it down more fully and to be, this delight of, I got it. And there is such joy and peace in my rather isolated life, in which I hope I won't see anybody all day sometimes, but occasionally see friends. It's years since I have been able to sit up at a restaurant, go to the theater, movie, go out to a dinner party. And you get rid of your worldly goods. A year ago, before Christmas, I took stock of, I'm really getting old. So I went through every drawer and every cupboard and took all the beautiful linens from way back in my wedding in 1923, and the loads of lovely plates, because it was a fancy wedding, and some of the precious, beautiful clothes, and all my jewelry, except for one pin, and all the things that cut it. I simplified the house down so that it was only a thing of quietness and beauty. And I had the time of my life giving away and getting rid of possessions and simply being myself with the few of the things I loved. Christmas Day, I had a womb. And I'd been out Christmas Eve to my sons. But I suddenly knew, took that step. I'm not getting old any longer. I am old. Up to then, I had always said, this is a sign of old age. I'm getting older. It took me a while to get over that one. And now I'm going along merrily, being very old. Death doesn't mean anything. Tell you the reason why I'm quoting the Buddha is that the first time I was up here, absolutely entranced with the place, I got the Dhammapada from the library. I could still read dimly then, and read it to a tape recording machine I had brought. And I hadn't looked at it again until I knew I was coming up here, when I took it out and listened. And he has quite a lot to do, to say about death, including you get rid of your possessions, you quiet yourself down, you know there is no way of stopping death, but death is stepping into, well, he has various expressions, beyond the shore, beyond the next shore, beyond the next shore. But there is that utter stillness. It is done. You have done your work. And I have that same feeling with no anxiety whatever about death. It is something I rejoice when the time comes, trusting it is not with too much pain. And I find that there is no anxiety. I have also another thing. I have cleaned my slate. I have divided up all the furniture, and a lot of it is good old family furniture. Let the kids take their choices. And I have everything in order in case I never arrived home from this trip. They know where everything is. They know who gets what. They know what the will is. And while I was doing this, I thought, am I preparing to die? And I thought, no, I'm preparing to live. And so, and that was about a year ago also, so I live. and I live quite joyously and quietly, except when I get mad. I think that's probably enough. I've asked some questions. And I've asked Eric to repeat the questions so I'll be sure of hearing them. And be as personal as you want. Couldn't care less.
What have you found helpful to deal with the pain, physical pains that come with old age?
I did hear that. Is the mic picking up? What have I found helpful to deal with the physical pain? Biofeedback has been the most helpful. Or self-hypnosis. Biofeedback is very much like meditation. You see, I can't meditate when I'm alone. It takes the magic, almost the whole group sense of meditation to enable me to get quickly into an out-of-the-body experience. When I'm alone at home, there are too many things to think of ought to be done. My mind is always like a beehive. And this stilling of biofeedback at that clicking machine tells you whether you have gotten down to a absolute mental stillness. It's very impressive. So that is one of the things. I avoid codeine, Valium, like the plague, unless I am in dire straits and being pushed. So that I use either attempt meditation or the biofeedback stillness. And the pain goes until I have weight on my spine again. Another question.
What suggestions would you have for someone who is interested in working with aging or dying people and has never done so at all?
I think number one is to listen to what they have to say. The first thing is to give them as much independence as possible.
Would you repeat that?
To give them as much independence as possible. Old people, one of my doctors said to me one day, I think you should have somebody live with you. My answer was, what do you want to do, kill me? Because I know perfectly well if I had somebody in the house, how would I amuse them? And also, I wouldn't lift a finger. Where I have to, water plants, cook myself, fill the bird feeders, take out the laundry and the rubbish, I keep everything in an absolute order so I remember where everything is, including items of food. I am busy. And if I had somebody to wait on me, I'd revert to being the little whining child who was annoyed things weren't done right. So that independence is number one, enabling them to talk about death and doing it very delicately until it is out in the open. The hospice movement knows about that beautifully. And giving love, because love is very important. Brought up in a family that was not demonstrative, I've been able in the last 2 or 3 years to say to my kids when they come in, my grandchildren, give me a big hug. Give me a kiss and a hug. And it is warm and close and loving. And it's a strong feeling of bondage and of richness inside. I think the the end of the way, as far as I see now, should be a serene and comfortable one, even in pain, because in such that kind of pain, you are given medication. But you've got to mentally recognize that you are near the end. Another question? Yeah, and if you're depressed, because depression is the chronic ailment of old age, and depression leads to the whole body, mind, psychosomatic system going awry, so that you may get any numbers of ailments. But there are so many depressed old ones that sit like this, with no light in the eye, and wait a minute, I missed the point of your question.
One of the questions was, I see a lot of people who, let's face it, they lose their sight, they have difficulty with hearing, they have other problems. What they do is they quit instead of trying to find a way to grow in other ways and use the faculties that they have left and even develop new ones.
They have been ones, I think, who never learned to learn the challenge of living. Over and over again, I have seen people who have lost their sight and who won't even get from the state, the government, the machines by which you can listen to tapes. They just go sorry for themselves, independent and helpless. And it's awfully hard to deal with that kind of depression. They may be passive-aggressive, in other words, helpless, but doing aggressive little things. It's awfully hard to deal with aging parents, I must say. That's one of my goals in life, is not to be a problem in any way to my children. But it's love, to give them love and caring for these people who do not want to be well, and who want to have life done, having to have life done things to them, and to be helpless. It's very difficult to move them. I have tried. I have had social work training and worked until I was 78. And there are some that you can't do anything with except listen and give them warmth.
I guess I'll preface my question with a statement, which is, I sometimes despair of there ever being a full opening between my son and myself. And I'm wondering what it's been like for you in terms of the connections between yourself and your children. Has there been an opening towards a peaceful sharing? How have you worked with that? How have you dealt with that?
Yeah, there have been breaks, or rather times, when they were very angry at me. My reaction has been, give them a year or two. Let messages of love from me go to them with no expectations of anything. And they come around. But I think the most wonderful thing is that as I have grown in old age and changed, they have just blossomed. They have searched in their own minds. We have these long talks about life. And I'm very happy and proud to see how it, between, let's see, they're 53 to 62, my children, to see how they are now taking on new spurts of growth without benefit of meditation. You'd have seen the same quick gestures and quick motions which I have now, but you would have, and you would have seen me struggling for a vague answer. You'd also seen me struggling with anger against my husband, the frustrations which weren't talked about then so much as the difference between man and woman, and how difficult marriage is. And I think that I was involved with first the children and then the children's marriages and the grandchildren and a husband who didn't want children anyhow and didn't want them to come. And so that it was, and then getting into social work too. Because the whole business of love is very strongly in here. And a woman is basically a nurturer and a giver and a lover. And so that if she denies those, she has denied something important. And the love which grew in a very, this second book was, this second published book was called Ordinary Marriage. It was ordinary in terms of the fact that like married, like, and educational and religious backgrounds were the same. But personalities, one was rigid and obsessional and the other was a fine hysteric. And the result was that the living together had its awkwardnesses. But I would have written very differently. My growth has come, I would say, the blindness, the start of blindness, because I have seen nothing clear for the last 7 years. The start of that. And that is one of the horrors we all dread. It's very manageable, but we are afraid of it. And there are many things that can be done about it. But I really had to face what blindness and dependence might mean. So I pulled myself up by the bootstraps, got myself for 5 weeks into the Boston Pain Unit, which is a holistic treatment case place, and was there, suggested that I come here. And I did, 2 months later, and froze to death. But I did love the food. I had never eaten vegetarian food before. And the night I got home, I thought, well, what I want is a piece of steak and fried onions. which I made for myself, and had the most awful attack of indigestion because I've gotten used to the light diet. Again, I never answer questions completely because there is no complete answer. I don't think I have. Having two sons for doctors, I think if I ever reach that point, they would help me. And I also have that new book that's out showing what medications you store, squirrel away if necessary. But no, there's always I may be able to say, I am so sick of this and so tired of the continual pain. Like sun out and sun in, the moods change. And once you find out what you're so desperate about and so angry about, then back comes that vibrancy again, and that delight in the mind and in living. And a terribly important thing is to use your mind and keep using it. Studying, curiosity of any sort. I keep up with the world news by U.S. News and Newsweek, which comes weekly. All these things come free. And Atlantic Monthly and Harper's and various magazines, as well as tapes of all kinds. Tillich, I was listening to, Paul Tillich, which is an old book, but listening to recently, was saying that, as I spoke of before, every death is about the courage to go through pain, and despair means that each time you do it, each time you have a little death, you are building up your security and your comfortableness about your own final death. So, I can't pick up that one.
He's curious about your ideas about euthanasia.
I think it's fine if you can get it. But be sure, for those who are absolutely sure, of course we've got the legal problems coming. Of course people aren't ready for it, particularly the doctors, only a few compassionate ones. But why should not a person who has lived life as well as they can, when they know they are ready for the end and do not want to go through, have not got the, I won't say guts, but the something that will carry them through more pain, go ahead. The whole Hemlock Society is aimed toward that. But I do think there are many. We've got a long way to go before the legal problems are handled. And the question of doctors pulling the plug. I think there's a great deal more of the quiet euthanasia than ever comes out in the obituaries.
In the last few years, what have been your sources of inspiration, and what have you done when those moods of depression have come upon you?
Well, my sources of inspiration are myself. In other words, I get so amused at the little things that happen, and so amused when I find out what I'm up to. And say, I got you. And the other half of it was, what?
If you're depressed, what do you do, or what will bring you out of that? How do you work with that?
When you're depressed, you say, wait another day. But try and find out what your depression is. Who has done something to you? Who has hurt you? What loss have you had? And what loss does it refer back to in the past? Because any one loss, like the loss of a husband, opens up all the other losses I'd ever had. And I think that, going back to the other question, suicide, we all deplore. And yet there are some who are going to commit suicide, no matter how carefully they're guarded. I'm afraid I'm one of those who say, if they want no more of life that badly, and treatment has not helped them, why not let go? And why is it any worse than all these soldiers we send out be killed, or our drunken drivers?
Could you talk of how long you were married, and what the experience was of losing your husband and being alone?
Let's see, we were married 53 years. And he died, thank God. I should not have made a pause after that. He died, thank God, of a massive heart stroke. So that he was terribly afraid of death. And when he opened the morning paper, he would look at the obituaries first, as if to say, well, I'm still alive. These friends of mine have gone, but I'm still alive. So that to have him go that way, it was just simply a cardiac arrest, was absolutely wonderful for him. A little bit of a shock for me, I must say, but it saved my seeing him suffer and be afraid. And he was, he was 78, a little young. I did not, with the old New England, keep your chin up, I did not grieve properly. I was back at work within a week and found it was tremendous help to help patients, and the patients helped me, the clients. But it took its toll in tension, body tension. And this was 6 months later, after his death. No, wait a minute. Year and a half later, meanwhile, I'd moved, bought a condominium, didn't ask any of the children's advice because they'd all have different ideas. So I moved, it's worked out beautifully, and they all helped move. But it finally caught up with me. I had not grieved. We had made a loving marriage out of those two different personalities, and we belonged. And so Still, I yearn to, in our double bed, to curl up against him and feel his strength and his warmth. A loss. But you have so many losses, and you finally accept them.
To add on to that, I suspect my mother never grieved properly when my father died. Do you have suggestions of how to help her?
How old is she?
62.
How old?
62.
62.
Yeah. My father died 10 years ago.
Oh, yes. Now, does she seem active and busy?
Yeah.
Perhaps sometime when you're talking with her, you can ask her to tell you more about your father and see if you can't get her with reminiscences and see if you can't perhaps get a tear or two going. And to say, you know, that's wonderful that you can cry about him. Because you've kept such a stiff upper lip. And it's so empty when a mate goes. And verbalize for herself the things she can't verbalize. That's best I can say at this moment on it. I would want to know more about it. To really give a decent kind of an answer. But for a son, it is a son to share with his mother his concern and identify with her unspoken concerns may be a big help. Wait a minute, missed it.
How important
is the Dharma in your life?
Only when I'm up here. In other words, the Dharma, I think, is I don't know what that to say. It settles me, or it is my spreading out. But I only focus on it. I live it. If I remember the use of the word Dharma rightly, it is a living in love and giving love and loving oneself so that one is overflowing.
You mentioned some possible advice to know about slowly eking in dealing with the death that his mother is now confronting. For myself, I'm wondering, do you see any signals, or do you have any suggestions about signals that you might see in a person
that
would suggest to us not to go into it?
Not at all. I missed the first part.
He was acknowledging your advice to the other question in regards to being with his mother.
Yeah.
At the grief of her loss, and is curious, and tell me if this is right, are there some signals that indicate when it is not skillful to things that you should not do or should not say? Is that right?
I think that if you approach the subject gently and are suddenly rejected, she's annoyed. You know the time has not come. She wants to go on with... It's very easy for us to keep a secret place of suffering in our souls. That this was done to me and I must be brave and go on. And don't anybody tangle with that. Don't touch it. Leave me free to grieve in my own way. And I think she'd give you the signal of impatience, or perhaps not wanting to see you next time you were going to go to see her. Be sensitive, and you'll probably pick it up.
On the same issue, my father's 65, and his father died when he was 13. And he's never cried since he was 13. And I assume he probably didn't even cry at that death. I don't know. Would you give the same advice to ask him to speak about his father, or is it too late? Is it, you know, too repressed, or what would you say?
I think it's awfully hard for a man to cry because he was taught it wasn't manly. I think, again, to talk about him. You see, I was taught never cry, and it's almost impossible for me to cry, even now as a woman. Some people just don't know how to. So that, however, you can grieve through words, and it's a very bad time for a child to lose his father, or either boy or girl. Because they're just coming into adolescence. And the role model is gone. And the one, they have not yet reached the point of devaluing, but still admiring. And if he has never cried, he is not a person who can cry, and but he could probably talk. So to say, I don't know whether, you know, did you ever have a dog that died when it was little, or lose a puppy, or bury a bird in the yard? Doesn't make sense, that's a little obvious, but lead into what a loss it must have been and how awful it would be for you if he had died when you were 13. You have to try it for size with a great deal of sensitivity.
He says that many of us are in the process of waiting for our parents to die through whatever process. And would you speak some about your relationship to your parents in their dying?
Yes. Father died at 85 of a massive brain hemorrhage. It was 3 months, but he was more or less brain dead. And that's an experience in itself. And I think that's in that first book of my persuading the nurse, just before he was dying, to give him a double dose of morphine. And that extraordinary joy, I felt as if I had him for the first time. The nurse and I sat all night long beside each side of his bed. And dawn came, and I walked out of this, what used to be our playroom, and he was in the hospital bed there. I walked out the porch and the lawn. The sun was just rising, and one of these peak experiences, these absolutely marvelous experiences of joy. Mother died at 85. She never recovered after father's death, so a series of little strokes, some angina, but just gradually fading, getting somewhat paranoid. But again, with her, the last days, I was sleeping there at the house, and when I woke up in the morning, the two nurses were just changing. It was 24-hour nursing then. And they said, she's only going to have a few minutes more to live. And I said, both of you, go down to the kitchen and get coffee. So I sat with her, holding her pulse, and saying, Mother, I love you. I love you. This is Harriet. I love you, Mother. And whether she heard it or not, it didn't make any difference. It was said. And then when her pulse was gone, and I felt her hand grow cool, I rang for the nurses. Satisfied, somehow. Both of them wonderful experiences. And again, that helped take care of any fear I might have had of death.
What are your feelings about mouth life?
What?
What are your feelings about an afterlife?
I'm afraid I don't have any. I have no religious belief. I only know that one lives as pure and full of integrity, life pure and with integrity and with inner joy. And when you're through, you're through. I'd hate to be up in heaven looking down at my children and all the suffering that children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to go through. I'd hate it. No amount of and how repetitious. And how
How's your energy? One more question?
One more question.
Okay. Here's
one.
Two more. I have one at the end. There's two anxious questions out here.
All right.
Okay.
When I learned that my mother was terminally ill, it became very important to me to talk to her about things that we hadn't talked about that I thought should be talked about, and I'm engaged in the same process with my father now. I'm wondering, I didn't see any indication from either of my parents, though, that they felt any interest in doing this. It was my issue, but I finally have elicited cooperation from them. Do you, knowing as you're approaching me, and have any desires to talk to your children about some things that haven't been talked about? Or
you know, actually, I think we've talked about everything. We have such wonderful conversations about life and the past and what my personality was like and what their personalities are. And I don't know that we've gone into the religious question very much, but I'm interested to know, do you think that rather pushing these questions or this communication on your parents has helped them?
I had 12 years warning with my mother. The doctor gave her up to 10 years. She happened to be at 12. So I went very slowly, just some things from childhood that I wanted to tell her how I had felt about, some of the things that I felt most positive about. Even sometimes I had felt hurt, and I moved very slowly. And there were a few times when she, oh, Mary, that couldn't have been, could it? And reacted like that. But I mean, I was very slow. I think my feeling was that it was a relief finally for her that some things had been verbalized that hadn't been talked about.
Good.
My father's a harder case. Still at work on him.
It's harder for a man.
My question is how to
this is the wonderful thing about growing old. Your passions do quiet somewhat. Your awareness, you see so much suffering, you've known so much of suffering, the world is suffering so. Of course, you're strongly identified with your children's pain. But on the other hand, you know that too will pass. And you give them the help you can. They come and talk about it when they're ready to. And all you can do is to say, I cannot suffer myself unduly. I've got to be, how does the Buddha put it, dispassionate with love. That's the AA cry too.
Okay. I have one question. Finish on, if you like. I read where a person in their 80s once said something to the effect that as he got old and he realized that he was losing his mind, he said it was a relief to realize that he wasn't losing very much.
That's a wonderful one.
How do you relate to that?
Well, the fact that he knew he was losing his mind shows that he wasn't losing it. But we have not touched on those who have brain diseases. And that's something quite different. And that's the suffering of the children, because I have a feeling that when somebody becomes really senile, they're not aware of time or their responsibility or they don't carry guilt. They don't carry conscience. So that it's the children who really suffer more. And whether I'm right or not, I don't know, but it seems to me that's so.
Well,
yeah. It's like the story of the porcelain-faced little old lady, so bright and cheerful, very old, who asked by a friend how she was. She said, I'm just fine. The doctor's given me a new back brace. The eye doctor's given me new spectacles. And I have new false teeth. And something else, she said, but oh dear, I do miss my mind. Maybe we better end on that one.
Well, that was one of the first applauses, or other than silent appreciation, offered in this room. And I was about to say what a joy it is and that you came, and I'm sure that you can feel the appreciation in the room, even though it's usually offered rather silently. But
and I am really absolutely delighted to be able to do this.
And will you come back next year?
Let's see how I feel next year.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.